right at the beginning of paper two. Old single column, page 33. So let's see, who'd like to start us off reading tonight? Got a reader?
Okay.
Well, he's getting down here. You'll notice there's a distinct transition here. He knows that he's been pushing the content a little bit in the first paper. There were definitely some times when we were going through that where it was a little labored. You had to kind of pick your way through it and notice all of the details he'd woven in. You'll see that he's wanting that to flow with a little freedom here to start out. So it'll go a little more fluidly. We'll have to point out an occasional thing that he's throwing in. So let's just jump in here.
Paper two, the nature of God. Inasmuch as man's highest possible concept of God is embraced within the human idea and ideal of a primal and infinite personality, it is permissible and may prove helpful to study certain characteristics of the divine nature which constitute the character of deity. The nature of God can best be understood by the revelation of the Father, which Michael of Nebadon unfolded in his manifold teachings and in his superb mortal life in the flesh. The divine nature can also be better understood by man if he regards himself as a child of God and looks up to the Paradise Creator as a true spiritual father.
All right. If it didn't leap out at you immediately in the first sentence, notice what he's doing there. It's an extended statement of the last sentence in the book. When all is said and done, the Father idea is still the highest human concept of God. So he's touching upon that sentence that we all know is very pithy and significant to reflect on. So that's where he starts out, and then he's emphasizing at the end there to what Jesus tried to do so much, that God is your Father, but in what sense? God is your spiritual Father. A true spiritual Father. So, he's immediately, and you'll see he's going to, work on that. He sees the problem that he's confronting is overcoming our hopelessly anthropomorphic material notions of God. And so, that's right in that very first paragraph. And then just notice one other little thing he's throwing in there that should have caught your attention, because we've been focusing on it so distinctly here lately. It may prove helpful to study certain characteristics of the divine nature which constitute the character of deity. Okay. So he's put that in there as well. For the little bit more experienced student that's begun to challenge themselves to distinguish deity from God. So in other words, what is he saying? If you're really going to overcome this historic tendency of mankind to just see God from a bottom-up point of view, so that God is at most just some sort of exalted anthropomorphic extrapolation of the thinker, of the conceiver of God. If you can challenge yourself to get your viewpoint all the way around to the top, to the unity viewpoint, where deity is first, and then God is personalized deity, that's going to very much help, you know. And but you notice the way he words it. You know, he doesn't say that this is definitively going to help you. You know, it may prove helpful. You know, if you've gotten to the point where you're ready to handle something besides just trying to wrap your mind around a little bit better bottom-up point of view. So, just, you know, it's really kind of cool how he words that. Yeah.
Chris, could you just go in real quick?
Mm-hmm.
Personalized, God is personalized deity.
Yeah.
What does the word personalized mean?
That there is a pattern, a purposing that is associated with that self, with that energy-minded phenomenon. That it's, that it's more than just an interactive phenomenon. It's something that progressively can choose to stand as an independent acting point in reality. You know, courageous and independent cosmic thinking. You know, that free will choice that stands apart from just, some very, very sophisticated mindful self that can do all kinds of very sophisticated interacting and reacting to the environment or other organisms. It can stand as an independent phenomenon and say, I choose. Now, of course, if it's going to stand independently like that long term, it has to choose to be part of the reality. You know, if it decides to exercise its independent potential to choose to be a reality unto itself, well, that wish is granted. You bubble off and cease to exist, you know, as part of the reality. But you have that gift of independent choice. An animal, for instance, you know, is just part of the cosmos. It has no choice to opt in or opt out. It just is part of the cosmos. It's been made so. But you, as a person, have been given the choice. You've been given the ability to eventually recognize the magnitude of the choice, that there is a reality that you can be eternally part of, and you have total, absolute control over whether or not you're a long-term part of that. And until that's a clear recognition in your mind that that's what's in front of you, it's impossible to be choosing to not be part of it. You have to choose to not be part of it, fully consciously recognizing what it is, you know, the eternal, infinite reality. And you're either wholeheartedly identifying with that in eternity, or you're wholeheartedly rejecting to be any part of such a eternal, infinite reality. Okay. So, personality is that highest phenomenon that can rule any system to which it's identified. It's spirit pattern. It purposes spirit. Spirit dominates mind. Mind dominates matter. You know, so it's on the top of the hierarchical potential control. And so to the measure that you've been given the opportunity to identify with a little portion of the totality of energy reality, you can choose to plant your flag there. I choose to give this, to take this initial gift that I've been given of a point of identification of a body, And I'm going to begin to build an eternal self, starting with that initial gift of grace.
So we are personalizing God through our experience?
No.
Is that what you're saying?
No.
My question was, how does...
So the only difference between you know, you just asked about personalized.
Well,
yeah.
So God is personalized.
Right. Right, you know, the only difference between you as a creature and God as a creator is what's being personalized. You're personalizing, just an energy system. God the Father is the personalization of not only an energy system in some sense, you know, a body, an infinite body, of course. I mean, it's highly transcendent of our concept of a body, but nonetheless, there is a point of identification, an identity. But it's more than just that which has been drawn up from the reservoirs of matter, mind, and spirit. It's more than just a threefold energy system that's being personalized. At the same time that it's a phenomenon that's been drawn up as an energy fact, it has associated with that deity, the fundamental unity in reality. It's not just personalizable; it's personalizable as God. You know, I mean, you know, there's many ways you can begin to understand what deity is. Its fundamental quality is unity. You know, it is that which, when you personalize it, you get God, not just something that is divine or potentially divine, but God.
Yeah. When I think of personality, I think of individuality. Is that, am I being too simplistic?
Well, it's, it's part of. Of that concept, yeah. In order for there to be a personality, there has to be an individuation of some sort that it identifies with. If there was, you know, if you didn't have the notion of individuation associated with this phenomenon, then all there would be is God the Infinite. You know, if this personalization phenomenon just took, you know, what you have with the I Am, the Infinite, and personalized it, you'd have God the Infinite, and only that. Mm-hmm. In order for anything else to be, I mean, you can basically, you know, it's another way of thinking about what was there to begin with. You know, you can think of, instead of saying the I Am, in the beginning there was God the Infinite. And God the Infinite chose to let go of that identification with infinity, you know, with the totality of reality, allow that to be individuated so that there could be multiple points of identification. Okay. And that's when you have a phenomenon that is hard for even high beings to understand the individuation of it. That's, you know, when they say, you know, we even have a hard time kind of understanding how this is a person because the individuation is very fundamentally a part of that. You know, but what they're really, you know, admitting to is the individuation in play is much higher than their ability to recognize. From my point of view, the absentite is not individuated. It's ubiquitous. You know, but the finite is, you know, individuated. But obviously, if I'm up in the absentite, I'm completely aware of the individuation in the absentite. But then I look up to the co-absolute, and that seems to be unindividuated, and, you know, et cetera.
Yeah. Yep. The creation of all of these beings and personalities sort of follows along with the whole scheme of creating a vast universe that you wish to be populated. You can't just populate it with yourself and have clones of you everywhere.
Right. Yeah, self-cloned phenomenon. I mean, you know, and again, you know, like we've said, I mean, the fundamental reason that there isn't just God the infinite, that there's something besides just that literal God the infinite, singular God the infinite, is because that's obviously not an expression of infinity. I can think of something that's bigger than one. I can think of two and three and four. So it's obviously not an expression of infinity. No matter how much I expand its magnitude, it's still singular. You know, so it's obviously not an expression of infinity. So, that's the fundamental reason that you don't just have God the infinite, that one personalization, that one infinite identification. It's because it doesn't express infinity. All right, so first paragraph, the last sentence of the book, expanded into a paragraph. How about the second paragraph?
The nature of God can be studied in a revelation of supreme ideas. The divine character can be envisaged as a portrayal of supernal ideals. But the most enlightening and spiritually edifying of all revelations of the divine nature is to be found in the comprehension of the religious life of Jesus of Nazareth, both before and after his attainment of full consciousness of divinity. If the incarnated life of Michael is taken as the background of the revelation of God to man, we may attempt to put in human word symbols certain ideas and ideals concerning the divine nature, which may possibly contribute to a further illumination and unification of the human concept of the nature and the character of the personality of the Universal Father.
So what's the sentence that's been expanded there? Of all human knowledge, that which is of greatest value is to know the religious life of Jesus and how he lived it. See, so he took two very famous sentences out of the book and expanded them. And they're both in, of course, the last paper, of the Jesus papers.
But how did he do that?
How did he do that?
How did he know what was coming?
and perhaps part four is actually part of the revelation. All right, so there, you get a nice little play off of the final paper in the book. And one little thing I wanted to bring out in there, because they use the terms a lot, and it's a great little parallel here to think about them. The nature of God can be studied in a revelation of supreme ideas. Okay, so now what does he mean by that? Idea is a bottom-up phenomenon. Okay, and if you take that formation of an idea all the way to its maximum, to a supreme idea. Okay, so take the bottom, it starts all the way at the bottom, take it all the way to the top. Supernal ideals. Well, ideals are top-down phenomena. And supernal means you're starting at the top of the top in this act of bringing something down to you. Not going up just little ways and bringing an ideal down, going all the way to the top and bringing it down. That's what supernal means. So supreme and supernal, ideas and ideals, the full bottom up and the full top down together. See, there it is again. A challenge to bring in that full bidirectional point of view into your thinking. So, the nature of God can be studied with that twofold point of view. All right.
In all our efforts to enlarge and spiritualize the human concept of God, we are tremendously handicapped by the limited capacity of the mortal mind. We are also seriously handicapped in the execution of our assignment by the limitations of language, and by the poverty of material which can be utilized for purposes of illustration or comparison in our efforts to portray divine values and to present spiritual meanings to the finite mortal mind of man. all our efforts to enlarge the human concept of God would be well-nigh futile, except for the fact that the mortal mind is indwelt by the bestowed adjuster of the universal Father and is pervaded by the truth spirit of the Creator Son. Depending, therefore, on the presence of these divine spirits within the heart of man for assistance in the enlargement of the concept of God, I cheerfully undertake the execution of my mandate to attempt the further portrayal of the nature of God to the mind of man.
So I guess I would stress that last bit to bring it home to a point. Do you want to suck the cheer out of his heart?
No.
Because it's sad to record that you do not take delight in cultivating the favorable conditions that would allow the adjuster and the spirit of truth to help you. I can't help you unless you've supplied the favorable conditions, unless you've taken delight in cultivating. I cheerfully think about why did he say that? Okay. It gives him good cheer if you're making an effort. He's willing to do his part as well. But if it's sad to record, it's sad for him. You know, that you've chosen, to make his effort meaningless. So he's trying to bring it home to a personal point. You know, he's gauging you in the first person and he's challenging you in the first person. Okay, so why don't you keep reading?
I just wanted to note that what's interesting between the second paragraph and the third is that in the second we're saying, pointing to the life of Christ as the maximum bottom up, top down. And of course, we're woefully have a paucity of understanding of that characteristic.
Mm-hmm.
And in the third paragraph, he uses words like enlarge and I think he says enlarge twice. So, this is the next epical revelation. So, everyone is built on the previous. So, maybe it's a first understand the life of Christ, of Jesus. And if you attain that consciousness, then we can enlarge it in this particular attempt here with some more information and just get a little bit bigger.
Right, but just remember there's a qualification to what you're bringing out there. How can you gain access to the sum and substance of the religious life of Jesus and how he lived it? He gave us his spirit of truth so that you could do that.
Yeah.
But the spirit of truth is almost wholly limited by you supplying favorable conditions. To actually access the truth of the fourth epical revelation, not just know about what happened 2,000 years ago. That's one of the things that the fifth epical revelation is reminding us of. It may seem like, I can read part four. It's all pretty accessible. So now I've got it. Now I've got the sum and substance. It's like, not if it's sad to record, you don't. You have the illusion of having, about Michael of Nebadon and his incarnation here 2,000 years ago. Not to take anything away from the faint flicker of faith and God's absolute love for the faintest flicker of faith. It's not like anyone's survival is in jeopardy or anything. But the fifth epical revelation is trying to very definitively say, okay, it's now time to not just do the minimum. You need to step it up. You need to swallow hard and you need to recognize that there is so much more to what you can access through the religious life of Jesus and how he lived it than you've ever imagined. And that's why I mentioned it in both the first paragraph and the second paragraph of this paper. Yeah. So, you know, it's a very definitive challenge to take your relationship to the fourth up to the next notch. Okay, so, but having said all this about how difficult this task is, he cheerfully proceeds forward to section one.
One, the infinity of God. Touching the infinite, we cannot find him out. The divine footsteps are not known. His understanding is infinite, and his greatness is unsearchable. The blinding light of the Father's presence is such that to his lowly creatures he apparently dwells in the thick darkness. Not only are his thoughts and plans unsearchable, but he does great and marvelous things without number. God is great. We comprehend him not. Neither can the number of his years be searched out. Will God indeed dwell on the earth? Behold, the heaven, universe, and the heaven of heavens, universe of universes, cannot contain him. How unsearchable are his judgments and his ways past finding out.
Okay, so he starts out with almost a full paragraph of little passages he's pulled out of the Bible and strung them together. And we've seen him do that quite a bit already. And so, you know, you can explore those at your leisure. I just want to point out one that you may have suspected a tweaking. You know, he's always tweaking these. Notice that very first little chunk there from the book of Job. Touching the infinite, we cannot find him out. And you're going, wow. There's a spot in the Bible where they say the infinite with a capital I. no. You know, the passage in Job says, touching the Almighty, we cannot find him out. Changes Almighty to infinite. Okay. You know, and it just, you know, it goes on like that. You know, we know he's always tweaking it like that. But, you know, it's basically there. He's just giving it a little bit more direct punch by taking the fuzzy recognition out of it that the human authors had when they penned those words. Okay, and then he goes on. You can see there's more quotes coming, so he goes on to the next paragraph. Okay, yeah.
Quick question.
Yeah.
How do you find these quotes?
The Parimony.
The Parimony.
Yeah. Right there, just and the Parimony's online.
Just wondering.
Yeah. So
has it been updated?
It's very easy. You know, that new version is online, and you can just, you click on the paper, and you can see all of the references. So it's very easy to do this on your own research. Okay?
There is but one God, the infinite Father, who is also a faithful creator. The divine creator is also the universal disposer, the source and destiny of souls. He is the supreme soul, the primal mind, and the unlimited spirit of all creation. The great controller makes no mistakes. He is resplendent in majesty and glory. The Creator God is wholly devoid of fear and enmity. He is immortal, eternal, self-existent, divine, and bountiful. How pure and beautiful, how deep and unfathomable is the supernal ancestor of all things. The infinite is most excellent in that he imparts himself to men. He is the beginning and the end, the father of every good and perfect purpose. With God, all things are possible. The eternal creator is the cause of causes.
Okay, now... think back what he said in that last paragraph of the preface. about the poverty of material, which can be utilized for purposes of illustration or comparison in our efforts to portray divine values and to present spiritual meanings to the finite mortal mind of man. He's giving you a little demonstration of what he's done to take up this challenge in the face of that poverty. This paragraph, I mean, it starts out, again, with a little bit from the Bible, you know, and tweaks like, 1 Corinthians doesn't say the infinite Father, it just says the Father, you know, things like that. But almost everything in there is not in the Bible. This paragraph, and if you're interested in the details, it's your homework assignment. This paragraph is demonstrating what he did. He took every so-called sacred text man has and consciousized them. And then penned one paragraph that takes a little passage from every one of them and strings it together. There's something from every sacred text in this one paragraph that he's put together. And so it serves two purposes. One, to demonstrate, you know, this is a divine counselor. His mind is vast. He not only took every sacred text and consciousized it, he took everything that humans have ever thought and simultaneously consciousized it and sift through it. Okay? He has a vast mind. And so it's a demonstration of that. It's also, it's just one paragraph. There's a poverty, okay, to work with. I'll distill a paragraph, but then let's move on to my own coin, you know, my own pen. Okay.
Here's the best you guys.
And you may have even noticed that, especially some of you who have some experience in Eastern religions. Did you notice the different flavor of the language in there?
Coming out of the Judeo-Christian tradition.
Sounds like Eastern, you know, verbiage a lot of times. See, right. Yeah. See, so it's coming from a lot of that's coming from the East.
Or even Muslim tradition.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's all there. So it's a very fun little paragraph. It's one of my favorite little paragraphs in the book that he kind of just demonstrates that he knows of that which he speaks. All right. So he starts out. So you see, he's got two paragraphs of quotes. One that's something from everything, including a little from the Bible too in the mix, and then one that's all the Bible. That's the thing. I mean, you've got that tradition has the most definitive recognition of a personal God. Of personalized deity. There's some notion of deity in the East, but personalized deity was never very clear. It's easiest to mine the Bible, even with all of the limitations of people writing 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 years ago. Still, there's, with just a little tweaking, you can really kind of get that in motion towards the fact of personalized deity. And so that's why, it has the lion's share of the two paragraphs. It has a whole paragraph unto itself. All right.
Notwithstanding the infinity of the stupendous manifestations of the Father's eternal and universal personality, he is unqualifiedly self-conscious of both his infinity and eternity. Likewise, he knows fully his perfection and power. He is the only being in the universe, aside from his divine coordinates, who experiences a perfect, proper, and complete appraisal of himself.
Or you could say, who experiences a perfect and complete self-appraisal. That would be another way to say that sentence, so that you don't get too confused about, the sense of the word proper there. That's like property. One's self, one's own. And I should mention, that reminded me, you may have been wondering what the heck does, in that previous one, what does disposer? the universal disposer. You know, it's like, you know, what does that have to do with, you know, garbage disposals? I don't get it. You know, again, you have to challenge yourself to know English better than basically any of us are taught anymore. You know, by that you mean arranger. See, notice the source and destiny of souls. Okay, he's in intimate touch with each. You know, and how they're spread out and how they relate back. You know, he is the universal arranger and arrangement. Okay. Right. You know, just it's position, right? Yeah, it's the word position. Yeah.
When he says here, he is the only being, the last sentence in the universe, aside from his divine coordinates, well, that would include this writer, the divine counselor.
No. He's speaking of the second, third persons there, those coordinates.
Right.
And the key is, see, I mean...
Right, those, but I'm including the writer, the divine counselor, those who don't have a perfect appraisal.
Right, see, and the big key is that's why I stress the, you know, what proper means there.
Yeah.
To make a perfect and complete self-appraisal, you have to have infinite objectivity.
Yeah.
And there's only three beings that have that. Okay? You know, it doesn't matter how perfect a divine counselor is, he can't transcend himself. You know, that's the thing about when you take this up from the finite, the supreme, the absolute, the ultimate, the co-absolute, the absolute, the co-infinite, the infinite, you know, that whole hierarchy, you get up to the top there, and you have all that self hyphen phenomenon in play. You know, that at the top, you're not only infinite, but you're self-transcendent. You can self-appraise perfectly and completely. You can see your infinity from above infinity. That's about the only way you can say it. I mean, how else are you going to try to say this? You know, it's a self infinite assessment.
The highest objective perspective,
right,
really.
Right. Yeah.
When you were talking about the disposer and the arranger of souls, you can bring it back home and say the Father chose to put your personality on this planet, in this portion of the universe, at this time, on purpose.
Yeah.
That's where you belong.
Right.
That's where you start out, and you move from there.
And he took all of infinity and all of eternity into account when he placed that, yes. Yeah.
The Father constantly and unfailingly meets the need of the differential of demand for himself as it changes from time to time in various sections of his master universe. The great God knows and understands himself. He is infinitely self-conscious of all his primal attributes of perfection. God is not a cosmic accident. Neither is he a universe experimenter. The universe sovereigns may engage in adventure. The constellation fathers may experiment. The system heads may practice. But the universal father sees the end from the beginning, and his divine plan and eternal purpose actually embrace and comprehend all the experiments and all the adventures of all his subordinates in every world, system, and constellation in every universe of his vast domains.
And he doesn't do that magically. I mean, that's a thought that humans have long had, but they've always understood it magically. Okay? There's no magic to it. He literally sees the end from the beginning. The tension that brings into play, when you try to wrap your mind around that, how can I be who I think I am with a personality bestowed on me and the free will and this whole, you know, seemingly endless sequence of events and rejugglings and everything that's going to go on between here and eternity. How can that be? And, you know, he sees the end from the beginning. You can't totally resolve that tension between those two viewpoints. The point is to allow both viewpoints and then allow the superadditive consequence of you allowing the simultaneous twofold viewpoint in your mind. By allowing that tension to be present within you, but not have it tear at you, not have it lead to stress, anxiety, et cetera, to allow that tension presence within you is to allow you to take the next step in relationship to the Father. Okay? When you think about the circuit of the Father, you know, and we talk a lot about universal Father, universal Creator, universal Controller, but you want to get a relationship with the whole circuit of the Father, and you've got to take that last step. Lastly, the infinite upholder. Okay? From the individuality viewpoint, what do we call the infinite upholder? The universal absolute. The tension presence, you know, of that relationship between the unqualified absolute and the deity absolute. To allow that yourself to come into relationship with that tension presence, with the universal absolute, with the infinite upholder, with the fullness of the Father, is to open up the door to the rest of deity. Because when you pass through that door of the infinite upholder, what do you engage? The mother. On the other side is the mother. You can't get to the mother internally as an inner life experience until you can establish a peace that passes all understanding, until you can establish a comfort in allowing the tension presence within you. Humans have long done everything in their power to try to avoid that tension. And how do you avoid that tension? You think of the universe in a dichotomy. You either scurry safely over to the unqualified absolute, you know, and just think about the material pragmatic things. Or, you know, you go over, curl up in a comfortable ball, you know, with the deity absolute and just be one with, you know, unity. And no relationship to facts. So heavenly minded, you're no earthly good, or so earthly minded, you're no heavenly good. Why do people go to those two? Because you go to one endpoint or the other, and there's no tension. Yeah, there's whole philosophies thinking that that's the purpose of life, is to seek the elimination of that tension by going to one end or the other. Okay, no. You need to grab a hold of both and all of the tension that you can handle and allow it to be present. Because as soon as that you allow that tension to be present within you, there's a flow within you now. The two endpoints are static. Okay? You as an individual in your life are stuck. Mankind as a civilization is stuck because they're trying to stay put on one of the endpoints. You have to boldly sail out into the high seas, grab a hold of both, and allow the full tension to come alive. Okay? Truth is there. There is no truth on the endpoints. Truth exists in the relationship between the two endpoints. You're just kidding yourself if you think you can go over and just go to the pure unity end and have truth. That's, there is no such thing. You know? Truth is in this associative block. Okay? Whether it's just as an actuality or as a full reality. Either way, it's in the associative block. You know, it only is accessible if you possess a relationship with this. And if it's sad to record, you know, that you haven't established objective mind, it's not there. You know, that you can want to have a relationship with the truth of the fourth epical revelation, but it's just not going to happen. You haven't supplied the favorable conditions. You're static, not dynamic. You don't have a relationship with the unqualified absolute. I mean, with the universal absolute, the tension presence. Yeah.
Infinite upholder, top down.
Yeah, the infinite upholder, top down. Yeah. See, and that's, I mean, I start with the individuality. Just, you know, you can appreciate the truth and everything from the individuality viewpoint. But you take it to the next notch up, see, and flip it around to the universe, to the infinite upholder from the universal absolute perspective. And then the whole vista of the mother, you know, is before you. That's, you know, because she is the downstepped expressions of the infinite upholder. You know, and if you haven't initiated your relationship to the mother by getting to the infinite upholder, you can't get to the mother. I mean, that's how the mother was initiated, is by, you know, that which initiates initiated the mother. The infinite upholder initiated the mother. You have to follow that, you know. You have to achieve a relationship with the infinite upholder, and then, you know, you can begin to have the full relationship with not only God without, but God within. Not only God as transcendence, God the Father, but God as immanence, God the Mother. God that connects individuals in a cosmic system, you know, like we read at the beginning. Okay? So, I wanted to, you know, stress that, because that's a really key point. You know, it's why they keep, you know, emphasizing both points of view. You know, supreme ideas and supernal ideals, and on and on and on, they re-emphasize this, so that you can begin to develop a relationship with the universal absolute. When I talk about this tension, I'm not talking about the false tension that most people think of, the supposed tension between the first level of meaning and the second level of meaning. You know, the level of the flesh, evil world, you know. You know, and the level of feelings, where they're not in vertical relationship, you know, they're put side by side as the side of the flesh and the side of the feelings, you know, and this notion that they're at war with each other, you know, and you would militantly reject one or the other, you know, is that, well, all those feelings that get you nowhere, it's all just mushy. Well, I mean, see, there's truth in both of the both sides' recognitions, because they're both extremely limited. They're just the first and second level of meanings that you've tried to turn into some absolute dichotomy that you're going to choose from and call one good and one evil. You know, the tension we're talking about is what happens when you get yourself all the way up to the sixth level of meaning and you've actually initiated the tension, the true tension, the differential between the zeroth level of meaning and the sixth level of meaning, that full differential, you know, on square one, of course. But it's your first experience of what the actual tension is between spirit and matter, between unity and individuality. Because the sixth level is the spiritual level. If you haven't gotten up there, you haven't gotten to unity yet. You have delusions of unity. Okay, you don't actually have unity, you know, and the individuality, well, you were born into it, it's there, inescapable, you know, but have you discovered the tension yet? Have you felt its full magnitude, you know, and have you, fallen back, or have you soldiered on? Effort, struggle, conflict.
Yeah.
Okay, that tension, see, that's the conflict. Okay, when you actually get actual unity in direct juxtaposition with individuality, okay, now you got some conflict, not some false conflict, you know, between, you know, flesh and feelings. Okay, so. So anyway, so this is, you know, you can just talk about this in all areas, and here they, you know, here he's bringing this up, you know, at the highest level, in terms of the fact of God the Father, and he reemphasizes it in this little paragraph here.
No thing is new to God, and no cosmic event ever comes as a surprise. He inhabits the circle of eternity. He is without beginning or end of days. To God, there is no past, present, or future. All time is present at any given moment. He is the great and only I am.
And take that, see, to the next level. You can recognize, I mean, you know, invoking the circle as an analogy to understand eternity. You know, that's been done for a long time. But, you know, when you see circle now, you should be thinking a lot more than just how helpful it is to think of eternity in a circle instead of in a line. You know, you have literally the circuit of the Father, okay, going around. He inhabits that all the way around. And then, you know, to directly recognize he is the great and only I am. Precisely how is he the great and only I am? Okay. His root here, the first center, the one side of the universal one of infinity. What's the label that we attach to the universal one of infinity? That's the I am as I am. Just I am as I am. You know, that's the point at which he directly, literally embodies that I am-ness that they're talking about. That's his root. That's his anchor. He is that, but he reaches out from that around the whole circuit. So just seeing the you know, how much there is in that besides kind of just what is immediately available and thinking about the difference between time and eternity. You know, and the theoretical concept of the I am as the starting point. You know, the I am is not only that theoretical starting point, it's an actuality of the present in a certain way. You know, it's bottled up in the universal one of infinity. And the Father has his root in that. And the other side is the Paradise Trinity.
This week I watched a video on a woman who had a near-death experience. It was a complete recovery from her stage 4 lymphoma when she recovered. But the sentence reminds me of her experience where she says, where it says, all time is present at any given moment.
Mm-hmm.
And when she was in her coma, that's what she was experiencing. And she, mm-hmm. her brother in India was getting on a plane coming to Hong Kong where she was, and she knew it. All she had to do was focus her awareness on a certain whatever it was, and she knew exactly what was happening at that moment. And the doctors that were talking outside her room, she knew what was going on there. She knew what was going on in her room. And when she came out of the coma, she would rehash and restate all of these conversations and all these happenings. And she was saying it was happening all at once.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm thinking beyond this earthly realm, everything is like that.
Well, it's steadily, I mean, it's just, all you have to do is just remember the relativity of her consciousness. She could see a measure of wholeness, but of course not the infinite wholeness. You know, and that's your journey, your ascension scheme. As you move up, you are steadily expanding the breadth of your consciousness. You're eternalizing your consciousness step by step. More and more you see, you see things in an extended fashion instead of just so much, well, at this second there's this, and at the next second there's this, and at the next second there's this. You remember we talked about this a little bit. It's not like as you go up, you cease to have a moment that you're in and then a next moment that you're in. There are you still exist moment to moment. It's just that those moments have a relativity to them. From our vantage point, as we look up to a being who's moved up from where we are right now, it seems like they that their moment, their second, is a lot longer than ours, and it seems kind of confusing. Like, well, how do they even think about things if a day is as a thousand years? How can a day be a thousand years and you have any sort of a sanity to your consciousness? I mean, they still have a moment-to-moment consciousness. It's just that, see, you start with God, the God the Father's moment is the whole thing, all at once. And then that's downstepped all the way down to you. When that gets downstepped all the way down to you, it's a length of time called a second. Okay? But as you move up, the second, the moment expands relative to that which is below. But at that level, that is their moment. For God, he has an eternal moment. He has an eternal second. His second, his present moment is everything.
So if you say, you got a second?
Yeah, but that's all I've got. Yeah. But it's an infinite second, so it's okay.
Seems like it's kind of in the realm of mind-boggling, so far beyond imagining what that would be like. That it's
right, and that it's taking it on directly like that. That's what you want to try to do. Don't let him be magical, mystical. Let him be deeply mysterious, but take on precisely what it is that's the difference between how you experience things and how he experiences things, quote unquote. Because you know what happens, when you get up to that level, the word experience kind of breaks down. And the only thing that you can say is that he's self-experiential deity. But still... there's a moment. See, it's just the only reason that you can't just say he's an experience, he has experiential deity, is because the moment is now eternal, and so that really doesn't make any sense. So you have to, the only thing that you can do is say is that it's self-experiential. It's the only way you can express that fact. Okay, let's read some more here.
The universal Father is absolutely and without qualification infinite in all his attributes. And this fact in and of itself automatically shuts him off from all direct personal communication with finite material beings and other lowly created intelligences.
I know he just stopped, but look what he did. He made a paragraph out of that. He wanted you to stop. I want to reread that. The universal Father is absolutely and without qualification infinite in all his attributes. And this fact in and of itself, forget about everything else, just that one fact automatically shuts him off from all direct personal communication with finite material beings and other lowly created intelligences. Okay? The whole notion of God that humans have had, that anthropomorphic notion, just went out the window right there. He just is challenging you to throw the whole ball of wax out. All the rationalization schemes throughout all the millennia that are predicated on the notion that the universal Father had some sort of direct personal communication with a finite material being or other lowly created intelligence, no. Okay? Shuts him off from all, not some, all direct personal communication.
So, Chris... There is the personality circuit.
Right. Well, let's not go on. The next paragraph talks about that.
Oh, okay.
The next paragraph is another thing. But he sets this apart. The first thing he wants you to do is like, okay, I want you to reset. Before you think about what's in my next paragraph, I want you to reset your whole notion of God and your relationship to God. You can't have any viable notion of the universal Father in the fifth epical revelation if you start with, you were talking to him in a burning bush yesterday. Okay, that doesn't work. Okay, you've got to put him at the infinite level, definitively. And if he's at the infinite level, you are not. I hope you recognize. You are not. You are infinitely not. Okay. And so if he's going to engage you, like you're about to bring up, if there's going to be some engagement, it's going to be in a way that's very different than anything that humans have ever thought before. He wants to make this, he wants to stress this point. Okay. You have to bring a whole new mechanism of understanding of your relationship to God the Father into play. Because you've got to actually bridge from the infinite level down to the bottom of the finite where you are in some literal way. You are not standing face to face. There's no direct communication possible, period. So how does it happen? Okay, so then he goes on. What does he say?
And all this necessitates such arrangements for contact and communication with his manifold creatures as have been ordained first in the personalities of the Paradise Sons of God, who, although perfect in divinity, also often partake of the nature of the very flesh and blood of the planetary races, becoming one of you and one with you. Thus, as it were, God becomes man, as occurred in the bestowal of Michael, who was also interchangeably the Son of God and the Son of Man. And second, there are the personalities of the Infinite Spirit, the various orders of the seraphic hosts and other celestial intelligences who draw near to the material beings of lowly origin and in so many ways minister to them and serve them. And third, there are the impersonal mystery monitors, thought adjusters, the actual gift of the great God himself, sent to indwell such as the humans of Urantia, sent without announcement and without explanation. In endless profusion, they descend from the heights of glory to grace and indwell the humble minds of those mortals who possess the capacity for God consciousness or the potential, therefore.
Okay. Before we go into the details, just notice that last little qualification, or the potential, therefore. If you have a bestowal of the Spirit of Truth on a world, you can have the universal bestowal of thought adjusters. So not only is it mortals who possess the capacity for God consciousness, those who have actually allowed themselves to be grown to the point where they have the capacity to receive an adjuster, like a third circler, but now with the Spirit of Truth, you have the potential, therefore, and so the adjuster comes predicated on that potential, not an actuality. So I'm reminding you of that little detail. But okay, so there's no direct personal communication. So obviously, if they say direct, you know the next thing they're going to talk about is the indirect. Okay. So what are the indirect ways? Well, one, he hands off one means of connection to the Eternal Son, who then becomes the top of a hierarchy of descending sons. And so that's an indirect personal link. Through the Eternal Son and the bestowal ministry, there's an indirect connection. Another aspect that you can think of as being originally possessed that was handed off is to the third person, to the Infinite Spirit. And there's the whole descending ministry of the of the angels, you know, of the ministering spirits. That's another indirect channel. So the second and third persons provide two of the, you know, the avenues around this absolute inability to connect directly. You know, there's a downstepping through those two avenues. And then there is a, you know, he engages you directly, but it's not personally. It's the, you know, and third, there are the impersonal, okay, mystery monitors. Okay. Now, where does the personality circuit come in that Jim appropriately brought up? And this is, you're being challenged to think again about what the personality circuit means. You know, you're said to be in the Father's personality circuit. Okay, what exactly does that mean? It can't mean that you're in direct personal communication. They just said that is not happening. So what is this personality circuit? If it's not, you know, a direct personal communication circuit, what is it? The key is to remember which absolute that circuit is anchored in. Is it anchored in the personality absolute? No, that's the eternal Son. The Father is the volitional absolute. You know, when you call him the volitional absolute, you're naming him as the anchor point of that circuit. You know, there's this, you know, the absolute spirit, and there's the absolute mind, and there's the absolute of matter, and then there's the volitional absolute. Father's a volitional absolute. This is, you know, technically, it's a volitional circuit. You have been made part of the totality of the exercise of will. Will is a potential. Personality is an individuation of that potential, an individuation of will. Volition is the exercise of will. So to be in the Father's personality circuit, see, is to be part of the totality of the exercising of will. And all of that is one. You know, it's all one circuit. You are a volitional being. You're a mind of will dignity. You are part of that actualization of the potential of will. Okay? So it's not a personal communication. It's a striking step with this flow-like phenomenon that is the Father. And that's where, you know, I told you in a long time ago, years ago, that when I first started getting this straight in my head, it's like, you know, we need to coin another word to really talk about this. Because the will is the essence. But when you start talking about this volition, and, you know, you're talking about, being a circuit, you know, circuits have a flow through them, you know. You need some sort of word that isn't so static, like the verb to be, you know, essence. You need a word that expresses this. And all you have to do, I mean, we use it all the time in English, just not precisely coined as a noun like this. Facience. You know, facere is the doing. You know, facet and face and all, you know, we use it all over the place. You know, we use that, you know, that verb to do, just like we used to be all the time. So, you know, this is, you're part of the facience of the Father, the doingness of the Father. Yeah? That's what you're striking step with. You know, it's a motion. It's a type of, a very high type of motion that you've struck step with, the facience of the Father.
Chris, I thought anything indirect is herstory.
No, what?
I thought anything that's indirect is part of the Universal Mother.
Oh. I mean, that's... Okay, we'll take a moment to just... That's the rest of the story about this. about the personality, you know, this personality linkage. And that's what we've stressed so much. You know, they're reminding here that individual members are not connected with each other except in relation to the whole and through the individuality of the whole. See, the Father is not this means of linking persons together. See? The Mother is. Yeah. So it's like, you know, that's what Jason is bringing up. I mean, you know, what you're looking for in this linkage, it's through her that we're linked one person to another. He just potentializes the system. You know, he makes you part of the facience, you know, that is volition. But it's still through her that those two motions come into relationship with one another and have any sort of synchronization that we would call a personal relationship.
Chris, I thought you were going to use the word cosmic harmony or something.
Right. I mean, just, you know, you can run with that, but that's part of why he's so, I'm stressing that he's trying to be so definitive here. He wants you to just put the Father where the Father is, instead of magically spreading the Father all over through everything. So there's a name for that. We were just talking about it earlier. If you spread the Father through everything, then you have God the Infinite and you don't have you. You can't spread the Father through everything or there is no you. You have to pull the Father out of infinity. He freed himself from the fetters of unqualified infinity. Okay? You have to allow that. If you force him to be in, then there's no place for you logically. He grabs infinity, and there is just a singular fact, God the Infinite, and he's it. If you let him in, you have to put him as God as transcendence. He chose that. He chose to pull himself out so you could be. If you're going to understand what he did, you can't, you know, somehow think that he's in and then it all happens just magically somehow. You got to let him do, you know, recognize what he did. He pulled himself out. And what the God that's left in, within, God is immanence, is God the Mother. That's what links you personally.
Isn't some of what, of understanding that really beginning to try to plumb the depths of what God's motive could be.
Yeah.
You know, that when you begin to understand God's motive as a selfless motive, that all of a sudden you can see how it is that, you know, okay, my religious upbringing focused on God as though God should be the center of attention for me because God is the center of attention for him. When in fact, God advocates for me to be humble because God himself is humble and has pulled himself out of the equation.
Otherwise,
in that selfless way.
Yes. If he hadn't done that, there wouldn't be humility. He's the source of the humility that you desire. Okay, he's an infinite expression of humility. He's the source of humility. He let himself be as little as possible so that you could be as much as possible. You know, and to get into the details, it's really fascinating to understand technically how something that's infinite sequestered itself enough to allow you to be. It's a pretty sneaky trick how he actually does it, you know, achieves that. That's going to the graduate level, like we're going to do when we start studying, when we go into total deity, to really go through all those details and see technically how that happens, how there can a place is made for his infiniteness to be that doesn't somehow push you out of potential.
The whole volitional circuit and us participating in it.
Yeah.
Also goes back to the very last paper.
Yeah.
And it's also the key to the difference that you know, universal question about subjective and objective. But here's the key sentence.
Yeah.
Man's contact with the highest objective reality, God, is only through the purely subjective experience of knowing him, of worshiping him, of realizing sonship with him. So that's, mm-hmm. that, you know, harkens back yeah. to exactly yeah. what we were talking
right.
about. His generosity in saying, your personality, your personal will is part of my volitional will.
Mm-hmm.
You're subjective, I'm objective, they can be aligned.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just a collective subjective type thing.
Mm-hmm.
There is this choice that
yeah.
I can do this.
And I've given you a way from here to eternity yeah. to slowly upstep your subjectivity until, you know, at that final point that you can envision the infinite all are, can embrace the infinite I am. But only there. You know, because if it's now, then there is no you, and there is no now. It can only be as far off as you can put it. You know, it has to be beyond the co-absolute. It has to be beyond the absolute. It has to be all the way beyond in order for it to be. And we'll come to a great passage that expresses that as we're, you know, reading through these early papers. So I don't want to jump ahead on that, but all right. So, yeah, I hope you get the spirit. See, he's got it. He has it up here. If you really think about what he's challenging you to do, there's a lot of productive thought that gets going here. You know, especially when if you're not a first time reader, and you can start to go, oh, wait a minute, that's, you know, and you can start bringing some of these key points into place, and seeing the Father in a whole new way.
In these ways and in many others, in ways unknown to you and utterly beyond finite comprehension, does the Paradise Father lovingly and willingly downstep and otherwise modify, dilute, and attenuate his infinity in order that he may be able to draw nearer the finite minds of his creature children. And so, through a series of personality distributions which are diminishingly absolute, the Infinite Father is enabled to enjoy close contact with the diverse intelligences of the many realms of his far-flung universe.
And just one little thing there. I mean, there's all, you know, otherwise modify, dilute, attenuate. There's all these things that you can imagine. But the one very definitive there, downstep. When they say downstep, specifically, what are they invoking there in, you know, in your recognition? What's the staircase?
God the sevenfold.
God the sevenfold. Okay, God the sevenfold. That's the literal down step. Okay, sevenfold staircase. Yep.
All this he has done and now does, and evermore will continue to do, without in the least detracting from the fact and reality of his infinity, eternity, and primacy. And these things are absolutely true, notwithstanding the difficulty of their comprehension, the mystery in which they are enshrouded, or the impossibility of their being fully understood by creatures such as dwell on Urantia.
But take up the challenge anyway, of course, just like we were saying. Allow that, all that tension to be within you, and notice how it begins to set you in motion. When you allow that, your life will begin to move.
The adjuster can work with that.
Yeah, the adjuster can work with that. He can't work with you scurrying to one safe static endpoint or the other. Okay?
It's the steering.
And fundamentally, again, why? Now, I'm going to stress it because it's going to be coming up. I mean, the adjuster is an individuation of what reservoir?
The universal absolute.
Well, or the infinite upholder, you know, from the top-down point of view. Right? And from the individuality point of view, that's the universal absolute. Yeah, see, he fundamentally is associated with that tension of the universal absolute. If you want a relationship with your adjuster, you have to allow that relationship to the universal absolute, because that's the only thing he can relate to. Okay? And that's why, see how sad it is, you know, that humans choose to not allow that. Because they're choosing to basically cut off any potential for any actualization of the adjuster in your mind. Okay, you've got to allow yourself to go out onto the high seas.
Because the First Father is infinite in his plans and eternal in his purposes, it is inherently impossible for any finite being ever to grasp or comprehend these divine plans and purposes in their fullness. Mortal man can glimpse the Father's purposes only now and then, here and there, as they are revealed in relation to the outworking of the plan of creature ascension on its successive levels of universe progression. Though man cannot encompass the significance of infinity, the Infinite Father does most certainly fully comprehend and lovingly embrace all the finity of all his children in all universes. Divinity and eternity the Father shares with large numbers of the higher paradise beings, but we question whether infinity and consequent universal primacy is fully shared with any save his coordinate associates of the paradise trinity. Infinity of personality must, perforce, embrace all finitude of personality, hence the truth, literal truth, of the teaching which declares that in him we live and move and have our being. That fragment of the pure deity of the universal Father, which indwells mortal man, is a part of the infinity of the first great source and center, the Father of Fathers.
And notice how he stressed the is. That's why I was saying, you know, he was about to get to the point I was just making, to recognize where the adjuster fits in. He said, look what he brings in here now. We've got, we've been talking about this ever since they brought it up in the Supreme Papers and said, well, no, technically, just as a direct factual issue, the whole in him we live and move and have our being, okay? I mean, the immediate womb that you're within, you know, is the womb of the Supreme, Universal Mother. And here, see, they're, you know, they've mentioned it, they've brought this up already, but notice what he does. He brings in a little bit more specificity. Hence the truth, literal truth. He's stressing, don't think about, you know, put the fact aspect aside for a second. If you've gotten to the point where you've read the Supreme Papers and you have the fact point in play, why if the fact is tied to the Supreme, do they even bring this up relative to the Father? And it's because there's a truth, nonetheless. The literal truth of the teaching which declares that in him we live and move and have our being. Okay, so we now understand how that works. You know, you're literally within a womb at any given point from here to eternity. There's always a womb that you're within. Where do those wombs come from? You know, they're a certain upholder, like the finite upholder, the finite womb. These are all downstepped expressions of the infinite upholder. Up on top, okay? The infinite upholder fills the infinite capacity, you know? So in that sense of beyond the immediate fact, there is the transcendent truth that all of this is within the infinite capacity. It's filled by the infinite upholder. Okay? So it's in relationship to that aspect of the Father, the infinite upholder, that you have this literal truth that in him as the infinite upholder, in truth we live and move and have our being. Okay, now think about it a little bit more. Okay, truth. We're talking about, okay, the infinite upholder, you flip that around, that's the universal absolute, that's the reservoir for mind. Mind is the associative block. Truth is in that associative block. So just see how it all fits together. And then he throws in one more little thing. That fragment of the pure deity of the universal father, which indwells mortal man, is, stressing is literal again. See, he doesn't want to use the word literal again, but literally is a part. Okay, how? Right, it's an individuation of the infinite upholder. See, for the advanced student, he's wanting you to see that all together as one synchronized picture. Chris? Yep.
How come it doesn't say anything like the calm and quiet voice within?
Because that's, we just haven't gotten to that point yet. I mean, right now, look at the title of this paper, The Nature of God. Okay, it's not the relationship of God to you. It's just trying to illuminate the nature of God first. So we aren't going to really, better appreciate the still small voice quite yet. The first thing he's going to try to illuminate is exactly what it is that is the origin of that voice. And then we can talk about how it gets attenuated so that it doesn't blow your eardrums out, when it speaks within you, because an infinite voice would probably scramble your brains. So how does he attain? There's all those issues of how the infinite God engages you. But before you go to those, those are subsequent papers. The first thing he wants to have is a new recognition of what that source is. And just notice how many times when we, now that we see more of the picture, he's bringing up the infinite upholder here. We talked about that quite a bit tonight. Like you've heard me say so many times, it's so clear to me now, that's the key. Once you really bring in some understanding of how the infinite upholder fits into the picture, then it just opens up this whole new vista of what's going on. A way to understand directly how this all hangs together. And you start noticing all of this careful construct in the book that's hinting at this. It's just all over the place. You can hardly read anything once you see it and not, be staring at it. It's just all over in the book. But you just don't notice that until you've really expanded your notion of God the Father beyond just some hyper-glorified universal Father, anthropomorphic, individuality viewpoint.
That's the transference, the infinite upholder, the universal absolute. It's a transference from all the potentials to actuals and, everything. I mean, that's when you're starting to get in touch with that. That's you're seeing you have the potential to have a glimpse into the whole of what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, even
and not seeing things in these digitized things that just wear you out after a while.
Yeah.
It's just this panoply that just,
even when you are first trying to get your mind wrapped around the three absolutes, you might ask yourself that question, well, why do they call that one the universal absolute? And it's kind of related to what, you were just pointing out how much ubiquity sort of, immediately comes into play when you start thinking about the universal absolute. Where is your consciousness? It's in the mind. The reservoir is the universal absolute. I mean, there's a number of ways you can understand why they call the universal absolute the universal absolute, but a very immediate initial recognition, it's called the universal absolute because it's out of that reservoir that everything that's experienceable comes. I mean, you don't directly, have knowingness in matter, substance, or spirit substance.
Right, it's in the mind.
Right. And so, really, what's the reservoir for the potential for an interaction? That reservoir is not the unqualified absolute, the deity absolute. That the reservoir for any associative fact of any kind is the universal absolute. It is where experience comes from.
Infinite associator.
Right. So, once you start thinking about that, it's like, well, no wonder when I start to really, allow that aspect of the Father to kind of be in play in my recognition of the revelation, that I'm recognizing it everywhere. I mean, how could you talk about anything and have it not in play? See, is really kind of the point. I mean, it has to be in play no matter what you're talking about. It is the experiential fact. I mean, again, mother, the mother type deity, that facet of deity is the overarching facet over experiential deity. And where does that mother deity come from? It's initiated by the infinite upholder. The infinite upholder is the key to really understanding experiential reality.
It's hard. It's the most difficult to see because we're immersed in it.
But it's made potentially visible because you don't have to somehow see the infinite upholder directly. You don't even have to see the absolute upholder. You don't have to see the absinite upholder. You don't even have to see the totality of the finite upholder, the whole universal mother. There's a downstepped expression of the universal mother that's local universe-sized.
Local universe mother spirit.
Right. You can get your mind around that. You can recognize her. Especially when you start to see how intimate she's involved in your ability to have any higher consciousness. She's the one that creates the place that is your heart. And I mean, the moment that you experience any of the dimensionality of that core within you, that temple within you, you're beginning to experience her. She has capacity. She's not a laser beam point like the Father. If you experience any extent, you've experienced her. She's a downstepped expression of the infinite capacity, the infinite potential, the infinite upholder. She in wombs focalizes and upholds. So, I mean, once you start thinking about it, it's like, well, I guess I actually have already experienced some measure of the mother. But I got it all, I had it all confused. I was calling everything the Father, and so the Father had to be two things that are illogically, at the same time. And so I had to make the Father magical, and it's like, no, just stop. trying to make the Father do everything. We remember when we read that, he may be all powerful, but he's not all doing.
He could be, but he's decided not to do that.
Right. He could be God the Infinite, but he chose not to be God the Infinite so that you could be. Right.
Okay.
All right, so a little bit of you can see they started with the infinity of God, and the next one, the Father's eternal perfection. So they do a little infinity eternity pairing. So we'll pick up on eternity next time. We'll dispense with eternity real quickly and go on to the next thing. We'll have that all figured out, in just this one short paragraph or section, and then we'll go on. So as we go into our reflection, remember how he replaced the Almighty with the Infinite to do just that, when he quoted that passage from the Bible. All right, let's take a moment here.